19 Uniform, thank you, descend flight level 110.
Zero, Shuttle 19 Uniform.
Join at 28 Romeo Yankee, we're climbing flight level 70 on the Otago departure.
Emirates Lake Delta Bay, continue right turn on navigation now to Dulles.
Blue Messenger for Victor Hotel, turn right heading 325.
Hello and welcome to For Flying Out Loud, a podcast that aims to inspire, empower and help all of our listeners to dream bigger. My name is Andrew Neofiti and it's my pleasure to be welcoming you to episode number 7, season number 2 of the For Flying Out Loud podcast. For those of you who don't know, a huge amount of work goes into producing these podcasts, so I'd be super grateful if you enjoy listening to them, you'd please consider buying me a coffee. You can find a link in the episode description. Now, it's been an incredibly challenging time for the aviation and travel industry since COVID-19 first impacted our lives almost 2 years ago now. Tens of thousands of pilots and aspiring pilots have not just lost their income, but also had their passion taken away from them overnight. I've certainly done what I can to try and keep people engaged and remain positive throughout, but it's a really tough job. And for all of you listening out there, I really am thinking of you. Now, some people are really, really good at this, and today I can't wait to speak to my guest who's done so much to inspire, empower and keep people motivated through these really challenging times. The For Flying Out Loud podcast is brought to you by Flight Deck Wingman, expert support to help you pass your airline or flying school selection process.
Juliet, we're just about to 120 knots on the island 24 right.
Virgin 23 Juliet, heavy LA tower, wind 26013, and the 24 right to the land.
To the land, 24 right, Virgin 23 Juliet.
He is an international Airbus A330 and A350 training captain and examiner who's logged over 25,000 hours flying for 6 different airlines in his 40-year career as a pilot. From humble beginnings in Melbourne, Australia, where he saved as a young boy for his first flying lessons, he qualified as a commercial pilot in 19 and worked as a flying instructor and an Aussie bush pilot, flying anything and anywhere to go from where he was then to where his career has taken him now. He's flown with some really interesting people, had some really interesting adventures, as we'll soon learn more about. And during the pandemic, he began an Instagram account to promote aviation, encouraging people to buy airline tickets and support all pilots, cabin crew and airline personnel with his daily pace of positivity. He now has over 330,000 followers and is a true aviation ambassador. Chris Pohl, or Captain Chris, at Captain Chris, if you're looking for them on Instagram, a very warm welcome to For Flying Out Loud.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. This has been a long time coming, hasn't it? I remember I was in Tel Aviv last October, it must have been, and we said, let's do a podcast. And here we are now in, when we're recording now, February. So it's taken a while.
I know, but you're a busy person. Yeah, isn't it weird how you chat to people, and especially as airline pilots, you sort of, it becomes normal, doesn't it, to just say, hey, yeah, I'm in Tel Aviv today having a chat to you from my bathroom, you know, or I'm in Santiago in Chile having a chat to you from a vineyard.
Absolutely, it's completely normal, because and it's also because we understand each other's jobs. We've been doing it so long, it just seems so normal.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But it's weird because, you know, for most people, traveling is something they do once a year if they're lucky to go on holiday. It is our job. Obviously, there's downsides to it. Maybe we'll chat about some of those, but mostly it's awesome. So I really want to get stuck into what gave you the aviation bug. What was it that got you, well, not to where you are now, but first gave you that bug?
I talk about this a lot when I've been on other podcasts, and it comes back that, well, the moment I remember was being a 12-year-old boy, and we were on our first ever flight. I'd never been on an airplane. I don't come from a wealthy family. First time I went on an airplane, I was 12 years old. I was the oldest of 4 kids. We were getting on board a Trans-Australian Airlines 727 at Melbourne's Tullamarine Airport, and being the eldest son, my dad pushed me sort of towards the cockpit and said, my son wants to see the cockpit. I didn't even know what a cockpit was, and I was quite nervous. My dad actually managed to push me into the cockpit, and the cabin crew said, yeah, come inside. And then this captain and first officer and the engineer turned around and said, oh, hi, what's your name? And I said, Christopher, and I was really nervous. And then next thing I know, the captain says, would Christopher like to stay here for takeoff? And my dad said, yes, of course he would. And I was strapped into a jump seat, as I know it's called now, behind the captain. And I was just mouth open. I was there mouth open watching what was going on, all these guys in this completely alien environment in this beautiful old 727. And halfway down the runway, I think I nearly screamed with excitement. And as soon as we got airborne and the runway was disappearing below us and the wheels were up and all the noise was disappearing behind us, the captain turned around. He said, what do you think of that? And it was like this. I was just dumb. I didn't know what to say. I was dumbfounded. I didn't know what to expect. And it was the most exciting thing that I'd ever seen, experience. And I remember saying to him, is this your job? And they just laughed at me. And that was it. They said, yeah, this is what we do. This is our job. And I went, do you get paid to do this? They went, yeah, of course we do. And that was how it started. And I thought, wow, I want to do that. I want to be an airline pilot. That is the coolest job in the world. And that's how it all started. And then it's a matter of finding out how to do that.
That feeling of getting airborne, particularly it's a bit of a dark, sort of dingy day on the ground, and then you punch through that cloud, and all of a sudden there's this bright blue sky, and you're like, well, I get to do this, you know, pretty much every time I go to work. Yeah, it's incredible. Why do they call it a jump seat?
I do know that, and I've forgotten it now. And somebody listening will go, it's called a jump seat because of this reason. Somebody knows, but I've forgotten the reason. Yeah. It was something about, it was for people. It was normally on the door of the cockpit door. It was on the back of the door, and you had to jump out the way to get on it and all that sort of thing. Something to do about jumping. But yeah, no, it is a completely interesting job. I still say now, every time I get airborne, if you ever fly with me and all the pilots who ever flown with me, as soon as we get through that moment where we punch through the cloud and it's blue sky, I just look across the cockpit and say, imagine if you could get paid to do this. I still say that every single flight because I cannot believe after 40 years, I still love every single takeoff. It's amazing.
Have you seen that cartoon meme, I think they're called, that says, you know, what the teacher said to me, you know, stop when we were in class, you know, stop looking out the window. You know, you're never going to get paid to look out the window all day.
Absolutely. There's two things we do. We do that for a living. I put one of my posts on Instagram, a picture of the Alps, the French Alps, with covered in snow. And I put the tagline was, and my geography teacher said, nobody's ever going to pay you to look out the window. And here I am. And the other one is, nobody's ever going to pay you to lie down. We have a bunk on board the aeroplane. I get paid to go to bed now. It's fantastic.
I know, it shouldn't be allowed, should it?
No.
Do you know, it's funny, actually, being a pilot, and I you mentioned geography there, I look out sometimes, particularly over flying over places like Afghanistan, and the terrain is insane. It almost looks like, you know, you've seen some sort of
moonscape.
I'm trying to think of the alien movie.
Alien.
And you see this terrain.
Like Mars or something.
And you
look
at it and you're like, wow, it's incredible. And I suddenly have this sort of fascination with geography now. I've got to go and look at a geography book and figure out why that mountain looked like that.
I used to carry a blow-up globe of the world. Right, because in the old days when people used to be allowed to come into the flight deck, I used to put a blow-up globe and I used to draw a line with the Texicolor of our current route and show people why we're travelling in some directions. Because they look at a map and they think, why aren't we going that way? And we're actually doing this funny curved route, as us pilots know, it's the rum line. But I've also got more and more interested in, like you say, the terrain of these places that we go over. And Google Maps is fantastic. Google Maps has changed everything. People assume that pilots know every single country in the world and every single... We don't. Yeah, we fly over some amazing places, but Google Maps is really improving my own personal geography. We know where we're going to, we know how to get there, but the stuff in between, it's amazing what you can see from the flight deck.
Absolutely. But you started out with this experience in the cockpit, but it wasn't like a right now I'm an adult and I've got a wedge of money and I'm just going to go and pay and do my license. You went down what we call the self-improver route, which kind of exists now with modular training for pilots. But what did that mean for you, Chris?
Well, we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. I remember, so 12-year-old boy wants to be an airline pilot. He says to his dad, I want to be an airline pilot. He said, oh, good on you, mate. Good on you. Just do well at school. That's what your dads tell you, right? but my dad didn't have the money for me to be an airline pilot. And I remember even things like I wanted to buy a skateboard. And he said, well, you need to go and get a job then. And so at 12 years of age, I went to the local, news agents in those days. And I got a job as a paper boy. And I was delivering newspapers before school. I had two paper rounds after school. I used to go to the local pub and sell papers in there. On weekends, I worked at Safeways pushing the trolleys, and one day I advanced to the dairy case where I stacked up all the cheese and the yogurts and things like that. And then I just basically saved up money. I then went down to Moorabbin Airport some weekends and got jobs cleaning the aeroplanes, refueling the aeroplanes, working on the front desk because it was before the internet and things like that. So somebody had to man the phones and put the bookings in and write things down and fill out paperwork and so like that. So I got known down at the aircraft or the airport, Moorabbin Airport, as that kid, that Chris kid. And every now and then I'd end up sitting in the back seat of an aeroplane and get a free flight. I never actually got to touch the controls till I was about 16, 17. But I basically just saved up. My dad was a builder, and so he was able to give me, he probably gave me a bit more than he should have, but he wouldn't have paid his labourers as much as me. But he always used to give me a bit of cash if I worked on the weekends with him on building sites. So I'd work, you know, Saturdays and Sundays, school holidays. And I basically put the money together for a what you call, it's not the modular, I did the, what do they call it these days?
Integrated.
Sorry. It wasn't called integrated then. There was a course in New South Wales at a place called Cessnock Airport, New South Wales, and it had a funny name. It was called NASA, right? And it wasn't NASA like in America. It was Nation Aviation Space Academy. It was a flying training school. And it was set up like the military. In other words, it was a nine-month course. And I remember the figure, it was some $30,000 Australian, which is probably equivalent to the £120,000 it is today. But I was 18 and I managed to save $15,000 of that money. So I'd saved up half the money I needed. And I had an uncle who gave me a loan for the other $15,000, which I paid him off, you know, over the next couple of years. And I paid him off in flight. So I used to fly him all around Australia. He came on all my Navexes with me. But 9 months into this fully integrated school, I was a CPL. But I looked like Freddie Mercury. I'd grown this big, dark, dirty moustache to try and make myself look older than 19. I just looked like a 19-year-old with a Freddie Mercury moustache. And this is what the hardest bit about the self-improver route is: getting that first job or getting any first jobs. Because who wants to fly with a 19-year-old kid who's got 500 flying hours? I don't. Right. And that was a hard bit. And I tell people it's not easy. You've got to promote yourself. I ended up doing beach and bay reports for 3AW weather. I used to go around the bay of Melbourne, Port Phillip Bay, doing beach and bay reports. G'day, this is a 3AW beach and bay report. And right now we're flying over Sunnyside Beach. It looks like volleyball's the name of the – and I just report on what was going on and what the weather was like and so on. I did that. I did target towing for the Royal Australian Navy. I flew an old Aztec with a target 4,000 feet behind it on a cable, and they actually shot at it with live ammunition. And people think – no, when people ask me, they say, yes, that used to be that must have been really scary, right? The scariest bit was the fact they very rarely hit the target. If they hit the target all the time, it wouldn't have been as scary.
Well,
the fact they never hit it, that was scary.
Do you know, I went through flying training in the military, as you know, and everything had gone okay. All gone absolutely fine until I got to the phase of the course at RAF Valley Flying a Hawk called strafing, where you went to shoot a target on the ground. To this day, I don't think I ever hit a target once. And all my course colleagues did. And actually, do you know what, Chris? It got to the point where I thought I was going to get what they call chopped.
Yes.
Because I just couldn't do it. And I remember sitting down with this instructor and he said, well, it seems like you're doing this about right. I said, well, you know, I'm trying to be a good student. I said, well, I'm not sure. Maybe I did it a little bit late. Well, you know, this bit looks quite good. You're at the right dive angle here. You're on speed. I said, well, maybe I'm 2 knots fast. And so it went on. And eventually he said, you're not getting this, are you? And I said, what? What? He says, go and have a beer. You've passed. I still haven't hit the target to this day. But I think that I owe that guy, I can't remember his name. I think it might be Nige Driscoll or something. I owe him a debt of gratitude, actually, because I thought that was my career over. So hearing you say that, it's probably just as well I wasn't behind you
No.
when you were towing that target, because I probably...
And the crazy thing was, the target was day glow orange. It was like a... it looked like a windsock, but it was towed around the opposite direction, right, with the thin end first. And the underside of the aircraft was also painted the same day glow orange. And we used to fly over ships... Right. I remember we flew over the USS Missouri one day. We went out, the USS Missouri had come over from the United States, and I went out from a place called Nauru, and I was in an Aztec flying around over the Pacific Ocean, and we put three targets out, and the Missouri hit all three targets one after the other. So, you know, there's a comment on the Australian Navy, because the Americans managed to hit it three times in a row. Australians never hit it in about the 3 years I was doing it. Or very rarely hit it. Sorry. So I did target towing for the Navy. I flew lots of charters for Channel 9 News. I used to fly news crews all around Australia when they had those massive big cameras that sat on their shoulders. And we used to cover the Sydney to Hobart yacht races. We used to land at all sorts of airports around Australia and covering that. Other sporting events, any major incidents that were happening around the country or around at least Victoria and southern New South Wales, which is the area that I was mainly flying around. I then did night freight in a thing called a Mitsubishi MU-2. So any pilots who know that aircraft will know it's either known as the Hiroshima Screamer or the Widowmaker. There was 19 of them in Australia. There's now none. All 19 of them have crashed. It was a very dangerous aeroplane to fly. But when you're 19 or 20, you think you're bulletproof. You think, you know, I don't care. I can't die in one of these things. I know other people do, but it won't be me. It's amazing what you know how resilient you are as a 19-year-old. You're bulletproof. And that's why...
That's one way to describe it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why the Air Force loves young guys to come into the Air Force, because you know you're the best. Because you're the best you're ever going to be at that age as well. Or so you think you are.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Do you know, one thing I often... Because through the business stuff I do, I'm obviously helping lots of pilots, so experienced pilots and aspiring pilots, but I get that, you know, seeing, you know, Captain Chris sat on an A350 flying somewhere exotic is awesome. And of course it is. But I'm often surprised that so many don't consider other avenues to have a very much a laser beam approach to an airline job. But actually, there are so many other cool areas to go and get stuck into. And all those things you just described. I mean, if I was 1920 again, I'd definitely want to go and do that. There's nothing wrong with going straight to an airline job. Of course there isn't. But yeah, definitely consider other areas.
But I think the other areas even give you what we know now, Andrew, is called airmanship, isn't it? And those sort of jobs give you that airmanship.
Yes.
You know, there are moments in those early years when I really, really scared myself, right? And a lot of young pilots do scare themselves because they do stupid things and think, oh, I got away with that, right? You can't do that sort of flying. You know, that sort of flying isn't acceptable in an airline. But the thing is, you get that out of your system and you learn so much about flying from those gotcha moments, those I learnt from flying moments. And I think the general aviation side of flying is fantastic for gaining that sort of experience. And also a lot of pilots who lost their jobs over the pandemic went back to general aviation. And the ones that I spoke to absolutely loved it. Obviously, they weren't getting the income, but they were loving the flying. They were doing things like air ambulance. They were flying Bandarandis. They were flying King Airs. They were flying Lear jets. And they were flying all around the place with their airline background and experience. But they were going back to GA and they were genuinely loving it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, yeah, I did love that sort of flying. But I was young trying to get into an airline. But going back is not a bad idea as well. I can see myself maybe flying. I used to fly float planes around the Barrier Reef. And I'd love that as a retirement gig, wouldn't it?
Oh, God, you know, well, that's my girlfriend is Canadian, and I have a dream, pipe dream, really, for retirement to go and fly a float plane around the Canadian lakes. Not to make any money, if it just pays for itself.
Absolutely.
But to do something like that, well, how fantastic would that be?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I'll be in the Barrier Reef, you'll be in Canada.
So how many types have you flown?
I don't know. Lots. I think just about every aircraft in Australia that was in Australia, I normally flew it. And remember, these are the days when I remembered flying when I first flew the Chieftain, the Navajo Chieftain. I don't even know what it's, a PA-32, somebody will correct me, but whatever that was. And I remember I jumped in this thing and I've actually got the owner's manual and I'm sitting in the cockpit with a news crew on board. And I'm like 18, 19, 20 years old. And I'm going, okay, engine start. Yeah, there it is, fuel pumps there. And you just learn on the job. Yeah, there was no type ratings. I was type rated to fly single engine aircraft and twin engine airplanes. And if they said, there's a Chieftain, go and fly it, you get given the book, you read it, and you go and fly it. You know, and when you're trying to transfer the fuel from the outer tanks to the inners, you pull the book out again. Say, how do I do that? All right, I hit that button. Oh, don't do it for more than 30 minutes. All right. And it really was like that. And you just got on with it.
That sounds like me on the line now.
But these airplanes didn't have autopilot. So you're sitting there hand flying them, you're doing NDB approaches, and you're reading a book on how to fly it because you were bulletproof.
Yeah, I know. Those days and the amount of times, actually even now when I'm flying my glider, I think, got away with that today. That was a bit silly, Andrew. Don't do that again. Those sort of learning moments, though, they don't stop, do they? Whether you're a commercial pilot, a private pilot, those learning moments never stop.
Absolutely. That's why there's two of us up there all the time on an airliner.
100%. So what would you say have been some of the biggest highs of your flying career to date? I mean, you know, people might assume, maybe it is where you are now flying a 350 as a long haul pilot, but what would you say have been your biggest highs?
Well, for all the pilots who are learning or looking at a career in aviation, obviously your first high is your first solo, and you never forgot your first solo either.
No, absolutely.
I think also your first jobs, when you're first flying jobs, when you know, whether it be in the Air Force or whether it be in the civilian world, the first job you ever get where you think, I'm getting paid to do this, to actually fly an aeroplane. The first time you get paid to fly an aeroplane. And then it just moves on for them and you go for different careers, different jobs and so on. And then you get to the point, I think the biggest highlight for me was being a 30-year-old long-haul four-engine jet captain flying into Kai Tak Airport. I mean, That was pretty cool. You know, I'm 58 now, but being 30 years of age, 30, flying into Kai Tak in an A340, doing the curved approach. And that was the old days when anybody could come into the cockpit. And I remember one day going in there and with my dad and one of my two brothers on the jump seat, flying the Kai Tak curved approach and glancing around and looking at my dad. And he's like got a tear in his eye. Wow. And I thought that was so cool. Payback time.
That's amazing. I mean, because that approach doesn't exist anymore, of course.
No.
You don't do that anymore. But that was That's a big aeroplane. And some of the listeners to this podcast aren't pilots. So can you explain a little bit more about what that meant and why it was such a cool thing to do in an aeroplane.
Okay, so Kai Tak, they get a lot of tropical weather around there, cyclone weather, rains a lot. The Kai Tak Airport was designed for old turboprop aircraft flying in and out of Hong Kong, and then aircraft got bigger with the 707 and then the 747 and the 767s, and aircraft got bigger and bigger, but the airport was still this airport built in the middle of a built-up city, and the only way to fly into that airport was to fly towards a hill that had a checkerboard, like a chessboard, a red and white checkerboard on the side of that hill, right? And if you came out of the cloud, punched out of the cloud, and you saw that red and white checkerboard, you immediately make a 90-degree turn, or about, I think it was 87-degree, turn to the right, and you'll see the runway and you land on the runway. If you don't see the checkerboard at a certain altitude, you then put full power on, you still make the 90-degree turn, but you climb and get away from the hills. So it was a pretty tricky old approach, and it was just... You had to do special training to go in there, but it was just everybody knew about it, and the pilots who flew in there absolutely loved it. And we actually didn't want that airport to close, but as aircraft got bigger and bigger, it was just safer to go to a new destination, and a new Hong Kong airport was built in 1997, I think, that opened, and that's the one that we use today. But yeah, the Kai Tak approach was amazing because you'd fly in and you wouldn't literally be between the buildings, but it looked like, because you were turning, you look out the window and you seem to be lower than the buildings around you as you fly around, and there's people hanging out there washing and watching TV and waving at you as you're flying into the airport. It was pretty amazing sensation.
And you have the capacity to see them do that. That's amazing.
Well, not while I'm flying, but if I was the third pilot or the fourth pilot sometimes, because you normally had four pilots going in there.
Yeah, such a long flight. I mean, you know, it's weird because as pilots, we've got what we call our approach plates. And again, any non-aviation listeners, it's like a map, but there's not a lot of like pictures of where the local pub is or something. it's just a map, isn't it, that shows you how to fly the approach into somewhere. But all these maps, apart from the directions being different and different numbers on them,
yes,
they all look the same. They're designed to enable us to get into these airfields.
Well, for SOPs, to make it safe, isn't it?
Yeah, to make it. Yeah, absolutely. And it amazes me. We can follow these maps and then we just arrive at these airports anywhere, by day or night, anywhere in the world. And but even though they're all the same as, you know, looking at the map, yeah, I'm going to fly this approach and follow that map and follow my operating procedures to get there. There's still some real favourite approaches that I do. What would your favourite approaches these days be, Chris?
You still must like doing the Kanazi approach. You've definitely done that one, haven't you, Andrew? The Kanazi approach into New York.
I haven't done it. Believe
you haven't
it or
done
not,
that one.
I have not done that yet. No. No,
oh, that's also a curved approach, but it's into New York. It's very similar to the Kai Tak approach, or it's the one that's closest to the Kai Tak approach. What approaches have you done then that are different? I can't think of any right now.
Well, I've done that in the simulator, so yes. I do know what you're talking about with that, and following the lights and things into Kanazi, the Kanazi approach into New York. But I think probably some of my favourite approaches are into Santiago in Chile, mm-hmm. because
I've never been there.
It's a really long flight. Beautiful. If anyone's never been to South America, you must go and visit South America if you get a chance. And and you're just flying in down. I mean, obviously, fly over the Andes, spectacular scenery, that sort of moonscape scenery. And then this descent, and you see all the vineyards up on the hills, and then you land in this amazing airfield, this sort of valley. It's just it's an incredible approach.
But also, I think coming into Los Angeles is amazing, isn't it? You come down, you normally fly over Vegas, and then you start your descent about Big Bear over the San Bernardino Mountains, and then you fly down in between, or just south of the mountains there, and if it's wintertime, they're covered in snow, and you're flying into LA towards the sunset. You've got the Hollywood Hills out on your right-hand side. It's a massive big city, Los Angeles. It's just huge, and you're just continually descending over this massive, massive city towards the Pacific Ocean where you touch down. That's incredible as well. That's always impressive. And it's so busy.
It really is. And, you know, pilots that haven't flown long-haul flights, and long-haul's got its downsides, obviously. You're away a lot. It's quite tiring and stuff, isn't it? But I remember the first time I landed a long-haul aeroplane and seeing palm trees going past the window, which was unusual because all I'd done was fly to Dalaman in Turkey and back, you know, 5 nights a week. And I landed in these palm trees and then I thought, and I'm getting off the aeroplane. And I'm not getting back on after putting some fuel on it 30 minutes later. I'm going to a hotel and I sat down by the pool having a beer thinking, this is absolutely brilliant.
I think...
It doesn't always happen that way, does it?
It doesn't always happen there. And I'm actually lucky in another way because I remember those moments when they happened to me, but being a training captain, I get to see those moments over and over again, especially when we get some young first officer who joins the airline and he might have come from short haul and he's done all his training and he's flown the simulator, or he or she, and they get on the aircraft with me and we explain what we're going to do. And then next thing we know, we're descending and they see these tropical islands, you know, in the Caribbean. And I said, yeah, there's Barbados. Yeah. We're going to be landing there. And they turn, and they've never been there. They've practiced it. They've looked at the chart. And then they descend and they're seeing this beautiful tropical island. And like you say, palm trees and beaches, and the colour of the water is amazing. And within an hour or so, we're on that actual beach that we've just flown past, drinking a rum punch and saying, welcome, you know? It's just an amazing feeling. I could see it over and over again with all the new all the new pilots joining.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And one of the other things I really love about long-haul flying is just getting to experience some really cool cultures.
Oh, amazing.
And different cultures. And I actually think, I don't know if you'll agree with me on this one, Chris, but we're probably one of the last generations to see different cultures as really different cultures, because I've just got this real fear that, you know, there's going to be an industrial park somewhere with McDonald's and whatever other company, I don't want to get sued over mentioning, just all looking the same. And that's going to be a real shame, isn't it, when that happens?
Absolutely. I remember the first time I went to Shanghai and the last time I went to Shanghai. So the first time I went to Shanghai was probably 2000. And I remember that everybody was riding on bikes. Everybody. I mean, you rarely saw a car on the roads. And from that until now, it's like there's cars everywhere. There's Ferraris, there's Rolls Royces, there's McDonald's, and there's Starbucks, and there's every other thing that America has all over Shanghai. But when I first went there, it was just push bikes, and it was very, very alien to my way of life. Nobody spoke any English. There was no street signs in English, and it was very, very different. It was very odd. I think Japan is probably the one place that I've noticed that hasn't changed so much. Japan still has, it's all very Japanese. Very few people speak English, and they are very, very different in the nicest possible way. I love the Japanese. They are just so efficient. I love their culture. I love the way they make use of small, you know, land. They just, everything's amazing in Japan, and the food's incredible. Yeah, Japan's still one of the few places I go to that hasn't changed much since I started going there in the early 90s. But most other places, unfortunately, are becoming very much the same.
Some sort of homogenous area. The only memories I have, or the one word I would say for Japan for me, is karaoke.
Karaoke.
I don't know if you visited the cage in Narita in Japan. Have you been to the cage?
The cage and the truck. The truck was amazing. The truck was basically did two containers off the back of lorries, and they'd welded them together, cut out the middle, and there was a karaoke bar with a bar at one end, a stage at the other end, and every single airline crew that went to Narita Airport was there that night. It was just amazing. It was just incredible. You were in Tokyo, but you weren't really. You were actually at the truck, and everybody just got up there and did their version of My Way.
Exactly. There's a lady who I haven't been to the truck. I'm not sure if the truck is still going. I have heard of the legend of the truck, and that may be you singing karaoke. Maybe you're the legend of the truck.
And the cage.
But the cage, yeah, the other karaoke bar. And
I was always singing Freddie Mercury songs.
You still had your moustache at that stage.
I still had it, yeah.
But I remember, every time I go to the cage, the lady that she either owns the cage, or she runs it, or she's a manager or something, she's always there anyway, and she always comes up to me and sees me, and the first thing she does is she goes, "Grease Mega Mix," shouts it in my face, and we have to go up and do the Grease Mega Mix. You can Google it, and I have to sing it like a duet with this lady in.
That's the cage. But it's like nowhere else. And karaoke still exists there. It was big back in the 80s. It was big in the 90s. It's big in the 2020s. It's huge.
It is. I think out of anything, more than flying the aeroplane, which is a genuine privilege, especially at the moment with so many crews out of work. But for me, it's a real privilege to be able to go and see these places, to meet these different cultures. You know, India is another area.
I was about to say India.
Yeah, and you know, everybody that you come across there is working so hard to make the best out of whatever they've got. Some real life lessons when you visit some of these countries. It's almost, I suppose, the ultimate would be like an astronaut looking back at Earth, wouldn't it? But you know, in some small way to experience this different way of life, it gives you a real different perspective on things, doesn't it?
What I was remembering about Delhi when you were saying that is when we go to Delhi, the crew hotel that we stay at in Delhi, one of the most fantastic things, and I can't wait to go with my next Delhi trip because I actually need some new clothes, is there's a tailor across the road from the hotel. And even if you're there just for 24 hours, you land, you get changed, you walk across the road, you see the tailor, he always remembers you, he measures you up, and he makes you a suit, and it's delivered to the hotel by the time you go to bed, a brand new suit. It's just incredible that they could just tailor you a suit, a tailored suit.
I had the same done in Shanghai. I hope you can recommend some, because I had one done in Shanghai. It was actually very well fitted, I have to say, but I chose from a small selection of materials, and I used to be into Shakin' Stevens back in the 1980s as a little kid, and he had this bright, shiny silver suit. And when this suit arrived about 2 years ago, it was bright, shiny silver. And it was the material I'd chosen. I just hadn't chosen very well. So
you've got to be careful as well. And you've got to be a bit specific as well. I remember I was getting some shirts made up once, and I was picking the materials. I went, yeah, I'll have a shirt made out of that. And he had some really nice blue and white stripes. And I went, oh, yeah, that'd be nice. A nice striped business suit. When the shirt arrived, instead of the stripes going down the arm, they went around the arm. It was just bizarre. I couldn't wear it. it looked like a French Brett on top.
If we ever get to meet up on a trip, we'll have to have
our bad
me wearing
clothing.
My shiny silver suit and you wearing your French Brett on top. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
If you're looking at preparing for an upcoming airline simulator assessment process, then look no further than Flight Deck Wingman. Flight Deck Wingman's evidence-based training and assessment preparation courses will give you the edge no matter what airline you're applying to and no matter what type of aircraft you're having your assessment on. Check out Flight Deck Wingman's airline simulator assessment preparation courses today at flightdeckwingman.com, and don't forget to follow them on social media. Just search Flight Deck Wingman.
You mentioned being a trainer there and how rewarding that is, and getting to see people sort of experiencing stuff for the first time. So what was it that made you want to get into training?
It sort of happened. Like I told you, I was a very young captain. I was very enthusiastic. And I live in southwest France near Toulouse, where they make the Airbuses. And I've only ever flown Airbuses. And because I live down in Toulouse, we were doing a lot of courses down here. And I speak French. And the training management said, oh, Chris, we've got a load of guys going down to the simulator next week. Their SOPs aren't being taught the way we want them to be taught. Could you just go in as a simulator, speak to the examiner and the instructors down there, and just ask if you could help with that with the SOPs, our standard operating procedures? So that's how it sort of happened. So I was just sitting in the back of the simulator. I got to know the instructors at Airbus. I got to speak with our pilots. And I was doing this over a period of about 6 months, and they needed some training captains. They went, Chris, I suppose we better make you a training captain now, because you're sort of doing the job for free. And I went, okay, that's cool. And then it just happened. So they needed training captains. I became a training captain when I was, 35 years of age. And I was doing like line training then. And that was incredible. That experience of being there on the A340, sitting in the left seat if I'm training a first officer, or the right seat training a captain upgrade, and flying into Kai Tak Airport and flying to New York and Los Angeles and Johannesburg and all around the world. But the best thing about training, the best thing is, you think you must be pretty good to be a training captain, right? That's how you think in your mind when you're not talking to people, when you're trying to be humble. You think, I must be a pretty good pilot because they've made me a training captain. But you're not actually a good pilot until you've been training for a few years, because you actually learn so much more, right? You think you know enough, but then when you see other people learning, you think, all right, that's how I should be teaching this, and that's how I should explain this. And you actually develop a lot. You develop your own personality, and you develop the skills at which you're able to put things over. And it's taking people from the known to the unknown, you know, and you do it bit by bit. You don't throw them everything you know straight away, but you just say, right, have you seen this before? No, you haven't. Okay, when I first saw this, blah, blah, blah. And you just, it's a wonderful experience, and it's a wonderful gift to be able to share your knowledge and share your experience with somebody else and watch them get better at their job. And that makes you better at your job.
Yeah, it's, again, you know, I haven't been a training captain. That's a long time away, because being a captain is quite a long time away for me, for various seniority system things at play. But as you know, Chris, you know, training people through Flight Deck Wingman just to be successful with their assessment processes.
That's fantastic.
And I find
what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I find it hugely rewarding, you know, especially when there's a huge weight of responsibility, I think, in any of these training roles, because this means so much to people. You know, I've had everything from, you know, people just leaving the military, joining the airlines, to this means I need to get this job. Otherwise, essentially, my life's going to fall apart. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And, you know, in not so many words. And that rarely happens. But actually, more and more now as we exit the pandemic and more people, pilots are hoping to return to the flight decks. There is a huge weight of responsibility, but it's a real privilege to be able to help people. I don't think there's anything much more rewarding in life apart from, you know, fantastic charities that are out there. But it does bring a huge weight of responsibility. Do you feel that responsibility? And are there some of the areas that you find really challenging as a trainer?
Not really, because I'm training very experienced pilots. I look at my job as not so much training, but more like coaching. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I'm coaching a professional team, right? These people are the best at what they do, and I'm just trying to make them that little bit better by just coaching them and letting them learn at their own pace as well. You know, I'll pose a question and they'll say, ah, okay, I need to look that up, and say, where would you find that? And just coaching them along the way. They're professional pilots, so I'm coaching them. It's not that difficult to coach somebody. It's difficult to train. So we don't, it sounds weird, we don't train or don't teach people, we coach them. We coach them to get better and to improve in their role as a professional airline pilot. So I'm trying to think, you got me off guard now. I'm trying to think of specific moments. Obviously, there has been moments when it's been difficult. and the most, actually turn it around again, the most satisfying has been the last 18 months of my career is actually training pilots back that have been unemployed, who actually some of them thought they were never going to get their job again. They thought they were never going to back to flying, especially if they're older guys. They thought, well, that's my career over. But to get them back in the simulator, they've been off for 18 months, and every single one of them, to a man or woman, came back and they thought, I'm going to mess this up. I'm going to be hopeless. And you just said, right, rule number one, you've passed. What? You can't say that. No, you're going to pass. Why can you say? Because I know you're going to pass, because I know you've put the work in. I know you've got the background. I know you've got the experience. Now go in there and show me how good you are. And like I said, to a pilot, they're excellent because they've got this pressure off their shoulders. They think, okay, Chris has told me I'm going to pass, so I'm just going to do a good job. And guess what? They do. They do a good job. They're fantastic. And I've not seen any problems with any of them. So again, I'm also confirming it's actually my job's easy, but my job's not easy. My job has a huge weight of responsibility, like you said. I have the responsibility to the airline. I have the responsibility to the Civil Aviation Authority to make sure that I'm running the tests correctly when I'm testing these pilots. But to put the person that's coming back for these tests in a state of mind where they're going to do their best, they always do their best every single time. And that's my gift to them, just to relax them.
Well, it sounds like you do a fantastic job. You know, I don't always find it easy trying to, you know, not all good pilots, for example, are good trainers or coaches. We know that. But having that ability to find a way to help somebody be the best they can be is a real skill. It takes a lot of work as well, and a lot of time and thought and care as well for people. I think you've really got to care about people.
Oh, you do care about people in this job, and because they're your friends, they're your mates, you see them all the time. And I think also that the best training comes in the debrief. You walk out of the simulator and they've got their notes and you've got your notes, and you all sit down and you maybe grab a coffee, and they look at you and then they look away from you, and you go, what happened on the old go-around? What'd you do there? Well, I didn't do this as well as I should have. And they always beat themselves up. And you go, but it was good enough, wasn't it? It was good. Well, I could have done better. Yeah, that's the right answer. I could have done better. And what would you have done next time? I maybe would have done this, or I'd do that. Okay, you diverted into this airport. Had you thought about going to this other airport? Well, I didn't think of going to that airport. Well, if you go on to the other airport, it's got a longer runway, it's got better service, it's got this. And then they look at me and they go, wow, you know everything. I said, no. I only know that because the guys last week went into the other airport and it was better. Right, so I'm teaching them by what I'm learning. So I'm always learning from the other guys, and I'm passing that knowledge on to the next team.
Yep.
And it's just a great way to share knowledge and make people better at their job, because by somebody making me better at my job, I can help them to be better at their job. And it's a fantastic feeling, and it's so satisfying. It's probably the best bit of my career is being an airline training captain.
No one ever does a perfect flight either. I help lots of aspiring pilots, future pilots, applying to flight schools and all that sort of stuff. But quite a few, they're really worried about this feedback type system. It's quite an unusual career being a commercial pilot, because it's something that happens on every flight.
Oh,
on every flight,
absolutely.
You're going to do something that you could have done a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to encourage, particularly very young people that maybe have not long left school, you know, actually, if we do an assessment, or if we chat something, or we interview and there's something that's not perfect, don't worry about it.
Mm.
Use it as an opportunity to do it better next time, because all of us are constantly learning, particularly in this job where we have to be so safe. You know, that's our primary job role, isn't it?
Oh, the day you stop learning is the day you should stop flying.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah, because that's, yes, absolutely.
If you think you know it all, you shouldn't be in the cockpit.
Exactly that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. If I say to you then, buy airline tickets like you bought toilet paper, does that mean anything to you?
Oh, here we go. Yeah, so at the beginning of the pandemic, we all, I know I did, I thought, oh, this will go for about a month, maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months. And as the pandemic started, you know, locking us down at our homes and things like that, I thought, wow, this could be quite serious. And what can I do as an experienced airline pilot to try and help the airlines? So I was back at home in my home in France. There was a guy on Instagram who would holds up a sign with some sort of message on a cardboard sign every day. And it was actually my son who said, oh, Dad, why don't you do one where you hold up a sign promoting the airlines? I went, how could I promote the airlines? And he said, well, and there was an ad, there was a thing on TV about everybody panic buying toilet paper. And he said, why don't you buy toilet paper like you bought airline tickets, or buy airline tickets like you bought toilet paper? And I went, yeah, I like that. So I remember doing it, writing it on with a big Texacolor on a piece of cardboard, putting the captain's uniform on. I'm actually standing, leaning forward so we get a nice big blue sky as I hold the sign up. And one of my son's mates was throwing the toilet paper, big rolls of toilet paper in the air while my son took the photo. And there's that sign that went all around the world, which was, you know, buy airline tickets like you bought toilet paper. And guess what, Andrew? It actually sent the message. You know, it was huge. It became a meme. I didn't even know. It was a 58-year-old airline captain. I didn't know what a meme was. My son explained that one to me. So a meme, it basically is something that everybody saw, and it all went around their phones, and everybody got sent messages and text messages. And I was being contacted by CNN in America, news in South America, Germany, people were using it all around the world. Travel agents were using it, and it just became this huge thing. And I do not want to be known as the toilet paper captain, but it became a really good message, and a serious message, but a fun message of, please help the airlines. Go out there and panic buy airline tickets, and that'll keep the airlines flying. As we know now, the pandemic went on a lot longer than a few months, but the message is still there. Buy airline tickets like you bought toilet paper to help support aviation and get us all off the ground and get us flying again. And it did work. I mean, I've had some experts tell me that it has managed to sell millions of dollars worth of tickets. And I'm not saying pounds, because it's not in the UK. It's throughout the world. A lot of travel agents throughout the world have used that meme, that picture, to try and support aviation and sell aviation and sell travel. So that's something I'm very, very proud of. But can we drop the toilet paper captain thing?
But I bet you thought, this is mad. Random picture with my son's mate throwing toilet paper at me.
Yeah, I know.
And it's had this massive effect. And then this, you know, for so many, particularly, young people getting into careers. I mean, Instagram is, to a lot of people, could be a bit alien, but it is a massive platform of social media. And that first point for you has just taken you on this trajectory on this social media platform that is Instagram. And what's happened? Talk to me about where that sort of, from that moment to where it is now, Chris, and how that's happened, how big it's got, what you love about it, what are some of the really positive things, maybe some of the things you think aren't as positive that have come from that, because it's from my perspective, it's helped so many people. So tell us a bit more about that.
It has been amazingly positive. So it probably started, I remember my daughter was looking at a mobile phone probably about 2.5 years ago, and she was flicking at a mobile phone. I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm on the gram, Dad. And I went, what's the gram? I don't even know what Instagram was 2.5 years ago. She said, oh, it's Instagram. And she showed me, and it was pictures of young girls and handbags and fashion and makeup. And I went, so why would I be interested in that? She goes, no, Dad, look. And she made me up an account, and it wasn't Captain Chris. She made me up an account, and she typed in Airbus. And I went, oh, there's an A350. So my first picture I put on my Instagram account was of an A350. And I went, oh, I can do that. And a few plane spotters liked my picture. And I went, this is really cool. And I was doing some flying training up around Glasgow when we first got the A350. And a lot of spotters were sending me photos. So I put that on my Instagram. Then I put some photos from the cockpit, and it sort of grew a little bit. And then the pandemic happened, and we found ourselves grounded. And then I did the toilet paper thing, buy airline tickets like you bought toilet paper. And from that moment then, I thought, do you know what? I could take this a little bit further. So I changed my private account to a business account. I got the name Captain Chris, and I thought, right, I've got a certain amount of survivor's guilt, and I'm not sure any pilot that remained flying throughout the pandemic knows exactly what I'm speaking. It's like, because it wasn't fair. People lost their jobs just because of the aircraft they were flying. If you were a 747 pilot and 747s weren't flying, you're grounded. If you were flying an A340, you were grounded. If you were flying a 787 or an A350 or one of these newer aircraft, you were flying, and that was me. And I had a certain level of survivor's guilt because I was actually still flying, still earning an income, still going to work every day. I mean, it was a very, very odd way to go to work with lockdowns and masks and travel restrictions and all sorts of things and living in hotels at Heathrow Airport. But I was still going to work and I didn't have that feeling of, will I be able to pay my mortgage next month? And I felt really guilty about that. So I thought, right, I'm going to do something positive here. So I set up the Instagram account, or I changed the Instagram account to, number one, inspire a lot of young people that were probably thinking about a career in aviation and who were thinking, well, that's my dream gone. And I want to inspire them. I have throughout the pandemic say, no, now is the right time, because by the time you get qualified, this will all be over and the jobs will be there. And this is where you come in now, Andrew, is you're helping those young people to get those jobs, right? So because it is happening, you've seen it happening. So my first aim was to inspire new generations of aviators, to motivate pilots who were already in careers and trying to find their next job and maybe, like you say, stay employed, and also support the ones that were unemployed. And that was the toughest thing, because there was a lot of people unemployed, a lot of my best friends and colleagues, and not just in the UK, but all around the world, by supporting them with just a positive message saying, hey guys, I'm out Los Angeles today. This is what we're doing. This is what's happening. We're carrying this. We're doing that. We're on time. You know, and just basically saying the airplanes are still flying. The airlines are still flying. We'll keep these airlines running. We'll keep these airlines surviving so that you've got a job to come back to. So I was supporting all of them as well. And then there was a lot of, because of the campaign I had with the toilet paper thing, there was a lot of our customers were wanting to know what was going on. And I was taking them behind the scenes with these behind the scene views of what we do. And so I was educating them. And all these avgeeks were going, oh, I love how you explain this. I love how I explain that. And also to keep it all together, I'd have a little bit of entertainment in there. So like I said, I stuck with this business plan of inspiring, motivate, support, educate, and entertain. And I've just kept that little cycle going on my Instagram, and I try and keep it so that there's something for everybody. I'm still inspiring those young pilots. And oh, here's every single day I receive 200 to 300 DMs, as they're called, direct messages. I cannot wow. respond to all of them now. It's just getting impossible. But I search through them for those young pilots, guys and girls, who have started a career in aviation. And the thing that my payment, I get nothing from Instagram. I don't earn a penny from Instagram. But what I do earn is the amazing feeling when I receive these DMs that say, hi, Chris, because of you, I've started my pilot's license, or I've started my CPL, or I'm now enrolled to do my ATPL, and I'm now this, and I'm now. And I get these, and I get 20 of them a day from all around the world, you know, Brazil, and they'll be in Russia, and they'll be in Australia, and they'll be in South Africa. Every single day I get messages like that, and I write back to them. They're the ones that I write back to, these young people who are starting their career in aviation, and they said, because of you, I'm becoming a pilot. And I love that. Absolutely love. My favorite thing about Instagram is that.
And it's grown just enormously. So, you know, again, people are a little bit cynical about these social media things, will say, well, it's just a load of rubbish. You don't have to do anything. That's lazy. You know, people that do make a business out of Instagram. But there's a huge amount of work. I say you've got absolutely no idea, because there's a huge amount of work that goes into making this work. Yeah. And your account now has more than 330,000
third of a million
followers, which is it's absolutely incredible. And so I know how much work you must put into it. And isn't it funny how the most rewarding things in life most often the ones that don't actually give you anything materially, no money, no objects, possessions. It's just that reward. And genuinely, your account does inspire and educate and help people. So I love it, Chris. I think you've done a fantastic job in what you've done.
Thank you very much, Andrew, because I love it. I love what I'm doing, and it's just evolved during the pandemic. And like I say, these wonderful messages, I'm just thinking of one I received today from a young boy in India who had no money. He was doing every single job he could, and he'd just gone down to his local flying club, and they've given him a flight in an aeroplane. I'm thinking, yes, that boy's on his way. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, one of the other things I've learned through these podcasts, Chris, and you're learning it through the Instagram channel. I don't have anywhere near the exposure with the podcast in terms of your channel, but it can be quite glib, can't it, to say to people, oh, well, if you work hard enough, you can achieve anything, because actually some people through, you know, family situations, through some pretty dark stuff that happens.
Oh, absolutely.
Possibly will never, no matter how hard they work, will make it.
And just by where they're born, where they, what country absolutely. They're living in. It's just difficult.
But if we can do something to at least those people that maybe if they can, and they, even it's going to be very, very difficult, if we can do what we can to support them, to inspire and motivate them, empower them, then hopefully there'll be, you know, some people that maybe thought they would never do it that do end up doing it. And, you know, and that I think is, you know, hugely rewarding. And it'd be nice to have some sort of tangible stuff out there. But I mean, the best thing that happens in my mind in this world is when humans help out other humans and people are nice to each other, because so much good comes from being nice to each other and supporting them. But I do think it's important to remember there's a lot of people that will, you know, never be able to have that privilege that we do to go flying, because they just, no matter how hard they work. But, you know, I'm certainly doing what I can to try and inspire and empower people to give it some thought that they might be able to achieve their dream.
But it's also beautiful when you get those messages from people who say, I will probably never become a pilot, but thank you for letting me fly in your cockpit by watching your pictures and seeing your images. And I think, wow, that's so beautiful. And that, again, that's every single day I get lovely messages like that. And it's just, it is incredible. It's the most wonderful feeling ever. And it actually makes me want to put that work in, to stick another picture up, to stick another post up, to post another motivational reel or something like that, just to get people going, yeah, yeah, aviation's cool. Yeah. Aviation's fun. And it's just, that's what I'm doing.
And it doesn't have to, and from my perspective, with my podcast, it's I've actually had people, I've spoken a lot about being bullied at school and being told, you know, I should give up the dream, wasn't good enough. And I had a really tough time at school. Great parents, great family, wonderful family, but a really tough time at school. And actually, one of those episodes where I just do a solo chat about that has really had an impact on other young people that are really struggling at school, being bullied, finding things tough. So it can reach a lot wider than just aviation. But we're using what we've got to do that, so which is really, really nice. But obviously, it's been a really positive experience. But, you know, everybody at some time in their life, Chris, struggles with things and finds things challenging. And I know that not too recently ago, you also find things a bit of a challenge. I wonder if you talk to people about that a little bit more.
Oh, right. Okay. So I want to really promote mental health amongst pilots as well. And there are some great charities that are out there that are helping with this as well. I've found that at the end of about 18 months of flying so solidly through the pandemic, I found myself, end of last October, I remember it specifically, it was my son's birthday. I'd been out with him in London. The next day I was flying off to New York, and I was just sitting on a train platform in London, and I was getting myself back to my hotel at Heathrow, and I was sitting on the platform, and for 40 minutes I just didn't know what was up, down, left, right. I haven't been drinking. I was just sitting there thinking, I'm just exhausted. And I'd never felt like this before. I just felt completely exhausted. I didn't know what exhaustion was until you actually feel it like that. And I got on the train. I went to the Heathrow Airport. I lay on the bed. And it was only like 7 or 8 in the afternoon. He was going out with some friends in the evening. And I thought, I can't fly an airplane tomorrow. I just can't. I'm exhausted. That's what it is. And I called up the crewing department. I said, hi, guys, I'm sick? Is that what you call? I'm one of these lucky people. I'm never sick. So I just called in. I said, I'm sick. And they said, are you all right? I said, I'm actually fatigued. I'm exhausted. And I said, okay, fine. And they let me have the time off. I then flew back to where I live in France. And I saw my GP and you know, in French. And he just said, burnout. He said, burnout. Vous avez burnout. And I went, burnout? Is that a French word? He goes, no, but I know that you know what burnout means. I went, oh, I'm burnt out, am I? I then called up my AME and had a chat with him. And he said, yeah, yeah, this is happening a lot with pilots. And I think a lot of it's psychological as well. Is that I've been working so hard during that pandemic to not just do my job, to not just train pilots, to not just keep the airline running, but it was just I'd been going that little extra mile to try and, like I said, with the, what do you call it? It's hard to explain. With the survivor's guilt, I'm thinking, I've got to work harder than I've ever worked in my life because other people don't have a job and I'm lucky to have a job. So I just have to keep working harder than anybody. And it just got to a point where I just went, I just can't keep doing this. I just can't. And I just had to stop. And people have said I'm brave. I don't think I'm brave, but I think it's a sensible move to realize when you're not okay. You know, it's okay not to be okay and say, do you know what? I can't keep doing this because it's just, I'm not safe. And that's it. You said it before. The most important thing about flying, and the reason we're checked and checked and checked on every single flight, is because safety is number one. We have to be completely safe. And for me to be that tired and that exhausted, I wasn't safe. And it took a good month of sleeping in my own bed every night to start feeling normal again, to start feeling having that energy again. And like now, we couldn't have had this conversation back in October when I spoke to you, because I was just exhausted. I'd be slurring my words. I was just like, now I'm back to my normal self now, but I just needed that time off. So basically, I want to say to any pilots out there that are feeling that feeling, and if you're feeling tired or exhausted, just cancel your next trip, right? Just call up crewing. The airline will still run without you, and the airline's management are going, don't tell pilots that. No, you want your pilots to be safe, and the most important thing is a safe pilot. And for a safe pilot to be safe, he has to be well-rested, right? And fatigue is a real thing. So rather than just filling in with fatigue reports, do something about it. Take a trip off. Speak to a doctor. Obviously, you want to get back in the cockpit just like I want to get back in the cockpit. So, yeah, it's okay not to be okay. Make sure you speak up. And also, just monitor yourself. If you're not feeling 100%, speak to somebody and say that. Because mental health is a real thing, and it's affecting pilots as much as anybody else in society, especially as we come to the end of the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I recently completed a course because, as you said, as a trainer, you're always trying to develop yourself as well and learn yourself so you can better help other people. And I'd like to give a mention actually to a guy called Christo. He was a flybe captain. I think he was a training captain, but I'm not entirely sure. Christo, if I've given you a promotion, you're listening to this. But Christo had some mental health challenges, and he then set up set up his own business running a what they call a mental health first aid course. And I was looking around to do something. So because during the pandemic, I was actually doing free career support calls, I called them. So people, if they were having a bit of a tough time, or they wanted to chat about their options or chat about anything, they could call. And it was really well received. But I thought, I need to have a bit more of awareness of when perhaps, it's a bit more than a chat with me, and perhaps I can help direct them to some more appropriate support. And this mental health first aid course that I did through Christo's company, Black Box Approach, it's called.
I've heard of that.
Was really, really good. Yeah, and I think, generally in society, there's a bit more awareness of mental health. But again, people are really glib about talking about people going wibble and all sorts of other stuff that goes on. And actually, we need to be a lot more supportive of people, particularly, as you've said so many times in this podcast episode, Chris, our colleagues that have lost their jobs, still haven't got jobs, or came out of training and don't have a job. And, are driving delivery trucks. Not there's anything wrong with driving a delivery truck. That's probably not where they expected to be after being a 747 captain.
No.
And, that is, it's a real challenge for people, and they're doing their very best.
That's really going to challenge your mental health.
Of course it is. And not because of the job itself, but it's just not where you thought.
Yeah.
You 1 minute you're flying this Kai Tak approaching a 747, the next moment, you're doing something completely different. I can wholeheartedly recommend that course. It was fantastic. Thanks very much for being so honest there about your own challenge of just being, fatigued, and Chris, because that's really, really important for people to hear. But things are improving again. I think the industry is definitely starting to improve at the moment. And, I'm certainly doing a lot more flying than I was. I'm seeing more recruitment opportunities out there. So hopefully at some point soon we'll be able to go and meet in a bar down route somewhere instead of doing this chat.
Well, you've promised to take me gliding as well, haven't you? You've promised to take me gliding. I've never been gliding. I can't believe that. 25,000 hours and I've never been in a glider.
You've never been it.
They've always had an engine.
Not once.
Not once.
Really?
Once. Yeah, every aeroplane I've ever flown had an engine.
Anyone that knows me will know that I am a massively passionate glider pilot. And it's getting back to that, like you were saying, with some pilots have gone back to flight instructional GA roles, getting back to that that just pure flying, I absolutely love it. So I'm definitely taking you gliding, because I'm only half an hour from Heathrow, so there's no
fantastic
excuse. Just come over a day earlier,
that's
it looks
best
like
offer.
A nice day.
I'm
and in
looking
fact,
forward to
I
that.
Just sold my glider, which is tragic. Yeah, we'll do it.
But you're getting a new one, aren't you?
My glider's just been sold. I am getting a new one, but I don't. That's not going to be around for a while. So I'm going to take mates flying in two-seaters. So we're definitely going to go and see that. But what's next for you, for you, Chris, or Captain Chris? What's next for Captain Chris?
Well, do you know what? Everybody that I speak to and the DMs that I get, they say, when are you writing a book? When are you writing a book? And I think, do you know what? The pandemic in itself, flying through the pandemic is enough for a couple of chapters. And then I think about the GA flying that I did and the way I started as a 12-year-old paper boy and the different airlines. I've flown for many different airlines. We haven't got time to talk about the airlines I've worked for. I've got enough to fill a book on Captain Chris. And also, this is my 40th year of flying. So I've been flying for 40 years. I've got 25,000 hours. I think that's worth writing down in a book. I mean, I've got a few more chapters to go, but I think I've got enough to keep people entertained. And that's what I think I'm going to do, because rather than answer every single DM, stick it in a book and people can read it in a book. That's the best way. But I want to build Instagram to the point that I want to be the Instagram pilot guy. I know that sounds like a huge goal, but you've got to have a goal. You definitely got to have a goal, Andrew, and that's my goal. I mean, I just want to be that guy, and I will be that guy. So, yeah, I want to be the guy that people go to and they ask that question. How do I become a pilot? How do I do this? How do I do that? I'll give them the answers. And if I can't answer them personally, there'll be a book with it all in there.
Fantastic.
That's my future goal, and keep flying.
I've got more of a random question to ask you now, mm-hmm. Chris. This is part of the winging it section that I ask in every podcast episode. So it's a totally non-aviation related role. So if you could go and visit any animal on this planet and have a discussion with them on any topic, uh-huh. what animal would it be and what would you like to talk to them about?
What animal? I love dogs, right? And this is going to be a bit sad, but my best friend died last year, my dog Carson. He was an Australian Shepherd and he died last year during the pandemic and it absolutely broke my heart. I'd like to talk to him. No. But not to do it to make sad. I just love that dog and I love dogs and I'd just love to ask him what he thought about me being a pilot, because I never asked him that question.
What do you think he'd fly?
He'd probably like to fly the Concorde. Yeah. Who wouldn't like to fly the Concorde? But
absolutely.
Yeah, or do some bush flying with me. He's a proper Australian Shepherd. Yeah.
I've seen one of these memes out there on Instagram, actually. It was a dog thinking to itself, sat in a room, I wonder if I should go hang gliding today. And then the next photo is him hanging from a hang glider with his owner and a little thoughts bubble coming out of his head saying, best decision ever. So, yeah, that would be
fantastic. I love dogs.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. Don't have any yet, but I would love one.
Oh, I've got three.
You've got three.
We lost Carson last year and we replaced him with three. Oh. Yeah, love dogs.
Right, what have you got? What are they?
A golden retriever for my son and a Kelpie and a border collie.
And they say owners look like their dogs, so which one do you look like?
I still look like my old boy Carson, who died last year. But yeah, my son's got the golden retriever, my wife's got the Kelpie, and my daughter's got the border collie. So they can have those dogs, but I love them all. They're fantastic.
I'm going to have to go and Google what a Kelpie is. I don't know what one is. But Chris, what would you like to say to the listeners that have been listening to this? Any sort of closing thoughts or messages that you'd like to put out there?
Like I've always said, with my Captain Chris account, I want to inspire people to take up aviation, even if it's just a private pilot's license. Do a private pilot's license and see what you think of it. If you want to take it further, or try gliding. I can't say promote gliding because I've never done it, but because of you, Andrew, try gliding, but try doing a private pilot's license. And if you think that you really like it that much, go and become an airline pilot, because there's so many kids out there who want to become airline pilots and they do a full integrated course because their parents might have the money and they're very lucky that they can do that. But that doesn't always make the best airline pilot, right? You've got to be an airline pilot because you want to be an airline pilot, because you really have that dream of wanting to become an airline pilot. And I knew I had it from that day one and I kept going at it. So go and do the pilot's private license first. If you really love that, just keep going one stage at a time, instrument rating and so on. And I want to promote and inspire anybody who wants to be a pilot. Follow me on Instagram, Captain Chris. Read my posts. I will only post positivity. Even if I'm not positive every day, nobody is. But when I'm positive, I send out a positive post. I will not post anything negative because, you know, there's enough negativity in the world. Just watch the news every day. But, you know, positivity is my thing. Just stay positive. Just stay motivated and just set yourself some goals and just keep learning. Keep learning. That's it. Keep learning.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chris.
That's my message. Keep learning.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and it's taken us so long. It's great to have this chat. Hopefully, well, next time it'll either be in a glider or it'll be somewhere random in the world, and we'll have a beer and we may even just bump into each other. It's one of those jobs, isn't it? We just bump into people randomly.
Absolutely. But I'll post it on Instagram, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, thanks so much for chatting to me today. And look forward to seeing where Captain Chris goes in the future.
Thanks, Andrew.